This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Your source for Pan-African news and world developments, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
a new report finds more people than ever before are refugees and internally displaced worldwide because of war, violence, and persecution. The UN Refugee Agency's Global Trends report shows an unprecedented 65.6 million people were forcibly displaced at the end of 2016, an increase of 300,000 over the previous year.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up.
Also, attacks by female suicide bombers in northern Nigeria have killed up to 16 people, and four extremists are dead after attacking a popular resort area yesterday in Mali.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, up to 16 people are reported dead after five female suicide bombers carried out attacks in northern Nigeria. Police say the attacks occurred last night near the Dolori camp in the village of Kofa. That's about 8 kilometers from the Borno State capital of Maiduguri. Borno State has been targeted the most since Boko Haram militants began their insurgency in 2009. About 20,000 people in northern Nigeria have died in the ensuing violence, and more than 2.5 million people have been displaced.
Mali security forces have killed at least four extremists who attacked a popular resort area yesterday near the capital Bamako. The Associated Press quotes the security minister as saying two people were killed in the attack on the encampment Kangaba. About 30 people managed to escape. The attacks comes during the final week of the holy month of Ramadan. About a week ago, the U.S. State Department warned of possible attacks on Western diplomatic missions in Mali and other places frequented by Westerners.
A new report finds more than ever before, people are refugees and internally displaced worldwide because of war, violence, and persecution. The UN Refugee Agency's Global Trends report shows an unprecedented 65.6 million people were forcibly displaced at the end of 2016 and an increase of 300,000 over the previous year. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency reports one in every 113 people on Earth is either a refugee or is forcibly displaced within his or her own country. Of the 65.6 million people forcibly displaced last year, the report finds 10.3 million were newly displaced. The UNHCR says this equates to one person becoming uprooted every 3 seconds. Data shows Syria has the largest number of displaced overall, with 12 million people either internally displaced or as refugees in neighboring countries and abroad. Afghanistan and Iraq have the second and third largest numbers of forcibly displaced people. But the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, says South Sudan is the fastest growing refugee and displacement crisis in the world.
The report, which records statistics at the end of 2016, indicates 1.4, to be precise, million refugees from South Sudan in neighboring countries, and almost 2 million internally displaced people, at least estimates. Those figures are probably higher. We certainly have counted at least 500,000 more in the first semester of this year in terms of refugees.
The report notes most refugees, 84%, are in developing countries, half of them children. While the refugee crisis is largely centered in poor countries, the report says most of the 2.8 million asylum claims made in 2016 were lodged in rich countries. The UNHCR says the largest recipient of new asylum applications was Germany, with more than 722,000 registered last year. The United States came in second, with 262,000 newly filed applications. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Poland's Prime Minister is busy today trying to explain remarks she made last week while visiting Auschwitz, the World War II concentration camp. She says her remarks were not anti-immigrant, but critics say they were in line with her position not to take part in the European Union migrant and refugee resettlement plan. Reporter Adam Easton is following developments from the Polish capital, Warsaw. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kapowa.
The Prime Minister, Beata Szydło, was in Auschwitz, the former Nazi death camp and concentration camp in occupied Poland during the Second World War. She was there to commemorate the 77th anniversary of the first deportations of Polish prisoners to Auschwitz. And she was there giving a speech, and it was mainly concerned about the need to remember the Holocaust and the atrocities that were committed by the Nazis in Auschwitz. But she also said this one sentence in which she said, in today's restless times, Auschwitz is a lesson that we should all learn, showing that we need to protect the safety of our citizens. Now, that one sentence out of a whole 8-minute speech was taken by many commentators, many political pundits, many politicians, from the opposition here in Poland, as being a justification of her government's migration policy, which is to say her government is refusing to take in any refugees or migrants because they say it is unpopular. And they also say that none of these migrants or refugees actually want to come to Poland. They want to go to wealthier countries such as Germany, Scandinavia, and they wouldn't stay in Poland even if they came. And therefore, they argue that they would be keeping those refugees or migrants in Poland by force against their will.
Now, the Prime Minister explained her comments today. What did she say?
Well, she used the fact that it wasn't cut and dry what she said in that speech. It was just that one sentence, and it depended on how you chose to interpret that sentence. Now, as I said, all of the opposition in Poland interpreted the sentence as meaning, oh, she's talking about we don't want any migrants and the Holocaust is a lesson. And what happened here in Auschwitz is a lesson that we need to protect our citizens from migrants. But she said, well, no, I didn't mean that at all. She was there for a commemoration event about Poles. Polish citizens who were taken to Auschwitz, not Jews in this case. This was the 77th anniversary of the first deportation of Polish political prisoners to Auschwitz. But anybody who's been following Polish politics for the last 18 months to 2 years knows the government's been pretty consistent about its attitude to migrants and its reluctance to take any migrants. And it was quite easy, in my opinion, to draw the inference to interpret what she said as her actually using the horrific events that took place in Auschwitz as justification for not taking in migrants today in modern-day Europe.
Would you tell us about the legal action that the European Commission is taking against Poland?
The European Union has a relocation scheme, and it wants to take the pressure off Italy and Greece, which are receiving the vast majority of the refugees and migrants from the Middle East. And it wants to share those refugees out more equitably, share the burden amongst all the EU countries. Now, Poland is one of a handful of countries which has refused to accept any. It hasn't taken any of the roughly 7,000 refugees that the previous government said, yes, we'll take part in this scheme. So last week, the European Commission said, after numerous warnings, we're going to start what it calls infringement procedures, legal steps, which could end in Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic being fined a substantial amount by the European Court of Justice for not actually taking part in this relocation scheme.
That's reporter Adam Easton from Warsaw. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kapowa.
Coming up on 15 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. A new report shows mixed progress in the struggle for religious freedom in the Middle East. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom says the government of Iraq has sought to curb sectarian tensions between Sunni and Shiite Muslims, although ISIS targets anyone who does not espouse its extremist ideology. In Egypt, the government has taken some steps to improve security for Coptic Christians who are increasingly targeted by ISIS affiliates. Daniel Pipes is the president of Middle East Forum based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi asked him if government oppression or failure to raise living standards may contribute to attacks on minorities.
I do blame the governments, but I don't think that poverty and unemployment are factors because, first of all, many of the Islamists are well off, are educated, come from good families. And if you look around the world at poor people, they don't normally go and attack and kill people of a different religion. You don't see that. It's an Islamist phenomenon. So I think it has to do with ideas, not personal circumstances. It has to do with your sense that the Ummah is in trouble and you have to do something to protect it. It's not about your own life. It's about the jihad.
So do you see a role for education in creating different environment where citizens are treated equally in these countries?
I'm not hopeful about that. No, I think what's needed is an alternative understanding of Islam that is not jihadi, that is not trying to eliminate the non-Sunni Muslims, but accepts their presence and doesn't resent them and is not angry at them. I don't think it has so much to do with education in schools as it has to do with the environment. Today's environment in a country like Egypt is Islamist. These ideas are very powerful. There's no idea against them. And when someone like Abdel Fattah al-Sisi talks about making changes, it's not possible. He's a politician. He's a general. What does he know about these things? You need people who are deep, who know the religion well. You need the people who are really knowledgeable about Islam to offer a different understanding of what it means to be a Muslim in Egypt in 2017.
So after the summit in Riyadh, do you see any role for the U.S. in protecting the rights of religious minorities in the Middle East?
Yes, I think as a matter of policy, the U.S. government should take into account the treatment of religious minorities and more broadly human rights. It's important. We should not ignore that. We should develop our policies towards other countries, keeping in mind the treatment of religious minorities. It's an important factor.
But don't you think that geopolitical and security issues take priority over human rights when it comes to U.S. policies in the Middle East?
I would say there is a tension between the two. One is our interests, economic, security, and otherwise, which are valid. Our government should represent our interests. But on the other hand, is our morality, our beliefs, our democracy, our human rights, civil rights. And that should play a role, and it does play a role, sometimes more, sometimes less. But actually, the United States is unusual, and there is this tension between interests and morality. Most countries, it's just interests, no morality. The United States is exceptional in the moral content of its foreign policy.
That was Daniel Pipes, president of the Middle East Forum in Washington, D.C. He spoke with reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi. Religious leaders from around the world have gathered in Oslo, Norway, not to discuss faith, but rainforest. They're meeting for the first time to talk about the spiritual and ethical responsibility they share to protect them. Joining them are advocates for indigenous people who live in the rainforest. The summit will address climate change, poverty, food insecurity, and human rights violations. Simon Rye is Deputy Director for Development Policy with Norway's International Climate and Forest Initiative. He spoke with me about the motivation behind this unique summit.
Faith leaders and faith communities haven't really been directly involved, as far as we know, in international initiatives to protect rainforests. They've been very active and involved in the process leading up to the climate summit and the Paris Agreement, but not so much on rainforest. And rainforest is a critically important component or part of the solution of the climate crisis. We know that emissions from deforestation and forest degradation is roughly the same as the total emissions from the transportation sector globally. So we need to involve and engage every relevant sector of society to do something about that. There are also very many other reasons why we want to reduce or stop deforestation and destruction of tropical rainforests. It's one of the most biodiverse biomes in the world. It's home to unknown, even at this point, species. It's important for rainfall patterns, agriculture, watershed management, and so on and so forth. So there are many good reasons to protect the rainforest besides climate. The climate is certainly crucial. We've worked with governments in important rainforest countries. We work with civil society organizations in rainforest countries and internationally. We work with private sector. But the one part of society we haven't really engaged so far are the faith communities. And they're vitally important in civil society in the rainforest countries that we're working in.
What role do you see religious leaders playing in environmental concerns, especially regarding the rainforests?
First of all, faith leaders, religious leaders, spiritual leaders in local communities and in mainstream have moral authority, they have legitimacy, they have an outreach that is unparalleled. In the deep rainforest in Congo or in Brazil, there may not be that many government offices or civil society organizations around, but there's a church in every local community. They speak with an authority and an outreach that is difficult to find. Also, of course, there is a spiritual dimension, an ethical dimension to this whole issue, the question of rainforest conservation for the future. Rainforests are an iconic part of creation, and all faiths share and embrace the importance and value of nature. So we've wanted to appeal to religious leaders and faith communities around the world for their involvement in the conservation, preservation, and management of rainforests for the future.
Do you see any challenges in bringing together religious leaders from various beliefs to have one focus, such as the rainforest?
There are challenges in the sense that, well, there are historical legacies that we need to have to overcome. But I think it can be done. And we've seen that very forcefully in the process leading up to the Paris Agreement and the summits which was held there, where faith communities came together very forcefully and produced strong interfaith texts and messages. So I think that can certainly be done. But these countries are diverse. There are many different faiths and traditions in rainforest countries that need to be brought together. The first step, I think, to make that happen is to provide a platform for faith leaders to come together and not to do things by themselves. We want faith communities and faith leaders to work together with governments, with civil society, with local communities, with indigenous peoples.
Do you see religious leaders and climate scientists working together as partners to save the world's last standing rainforests?
Absolutely. There's a lot of science and knowledge out there about the importance of rainforests and the critical role that they play for life on Earth. And we need to bring that knowledge together with the moral authority and the outreach that faith communities leaders can provide. But also, I think we need to see the even bigger picture, which is bringing together governments and other local community, civil society actors together with faith leaders so that all the important actors in society in rainforest countries are brought together on the same table. That, I think, is crucial. They have a role to play, which hasn't so far really happened, and we want to see that. That's one of the reasons why we're initiating this initiative.
Simon Rye is Deputy Director for Development Policy with Norway's International Climate and Forest Initiative. He spoke with me from Oslo, Norway.
I In Rome, the UN Food and Agricultural Organization is hosting an international seminar on drought. FAO Director General Jose Graziano da Silva says building the resilience of farmers is fundamental to facing extreme drought. Graziano da Silva is from Portugal, which is experiencing massive wildfires due to drought.
Heat waves in southern Europe are presenting increasing challenge, and wildfires that are associated with drought are destroying our forest and our biodiversity in many of those areas of pasture land.
The FAO chief says drought is becoming more and more frequent due to climate change.
When people die in the context of drought, it's not because they are suffering from a harmful climate event. People die because they are not prepared to face the impacts of the drought, because their livelihoods are not resilient enough. It has been said by Ambassador of the Netherlands, and I would like to repeat, we cannot avoid the drought, but we can avoid its consequence, like people dying or become a famine situation. Most of the time, poor rural communities of developing countries don't even know that a drought is about to strike. They are not properly informed. They have no knowledge about that.
He says the drought cannot be avoided, but local food production can be saved.
The impacts of the drought can go much beyond human costs. They can generate social instability and also perpetuate a cycle of poverty and aid dependency that may endure for decades. This is exactly what is happening in Africa, unfortunately. This combination of drought and conflict is the worst situation that we are facing nowadays.
The FAO Director General says while it's important to provide emergency assistance during drought, investing in preparedness and resilience is essential. He says that allows countries to act to save livelihoods before it's too late. He adds that there is no food security without peace and no peace without food security. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Thomas Blondet, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next, Straight Talk Africa, a preview of the Kenyan presidential election. The race between incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta and Raila Odinga. The main opposition candidate is looking increasingly competitive. A discussion on Kenya's presidential election on the next, Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.